This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The Academy Award presentations are coming up next weekend, and it could be a big night for our guest, filmmaker Danny Boyle. His latest movie, Slumdog Millionaire, earned 10 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture and Best Director. Boyle has been directing feature films since 1995 and is probably best known for the films 28 Days Later and Trainspotting. Slumdog Millionaire is set in India. It's the story of an orphan boy, Jamal, from a Mumbai slum who grows up and becomes a contestant on the Indian version of the game show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? In this scene, Jamal, played by Dev Patel, has just correctly answered a question from the host, played by Bollywood star Anil Kapoor.
You're absolutely right!
It's getting hot in here.
Are you nervous?
What? Am I nervous? It's you who's in the hot seat, my friend.
Oh, yes.
Sorry.
Bloody hell, he's got prey on the run.
Finally.
A few hours ago, you were giving chai for the Phonewallahs. And now you're richer than they will ever be. Walla player. Ladies and gentlemen, Walla player!
Because he does so well on the show, Jamal is arrested on suspicion of cheating. His interrogation by the police reveals his remarkable story of escaping Mumbai slums and making his way in a rapidly changing India. I spoke to Danny Boyle last year when Slumdog Millionaire was released. Danny Boyle, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, this film kind of just grabs you by the collar early on with this opening. I guess it's the opening scene or an early scene in which you see some slum kids playing kind of a makeshift game of cricket on, I guess, what looks like an airport tarmac. And the security guards come and say, you know, private land, get out of here. And they chase them into this shanty town. And there's this scene that I don't know how long it takes, but it is the most amazing look at this massive, sprawling slum. And it includes aerial shots and chases through various places. I want to talk a little bit about it. It just gets you into this city in a way that is just visceral. Talk a little bit about that scene.
That was the whole idea, really, was because we thought, you know, as Westerners going there, because we only took like 10 crew. The rest of the crew are drawn from Bollywood. But I thought as a Westerner going there and trying to make a film about a kid growing up there, that you're just going to have to film the film as subjectively as possible and just literally tip the audience in off the edge of a cliff and just see how you get on. And the way we did that was through this chase sequence at the beginning where you literally, there's no like wide shots where you go, hello everybody, this is India, hello everybody, this is Mumbai. And, you know, it's actually, so you don't settle people into the film, you just hurtle them into it, full pelt. And that's what it's like arriving there. That I remember the first time I arrived, you were just overwhelmed by the sensory experience of the film. And you think, if I don't start moving very, very quickly, I'm just going to be swept away by this, you know. You have to catch up very, very quickly. And so the idea was to propel the audience into the environment and leave you no choice, really. You're either going to leave the theatre with a migraine or you're going to settle in and start to absorb this extraordinary city, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to get too technical, but when I looked at those chase scenes, and it's very tight quarters because people are crammed together and their makeshift, you know, habitats are all very close. I couldn't imagine getting a sound boom and lighting and all the stuff that goes with the movie set. How did you film it?
With a very small crew. They're very narrow laneways. And obviously, I mean, as you probably know, in any community, a film crew is disruptive. You know, it disrupts the rhythm and access for a community. We were still very disruptive, but we took a small crew and we filmed with very small digital cameras, which allowed us to capture the dynamism of the place, really, as well as actually not disrupt it too much ourselves. And people were very generous and welcoming to us. We filmed in two slums, a small slum by the airport called Juhu, and an extraordinary slum, which is a slum of at least 2 million people. Some say it's the biggest slum on earth, called Dharavi. And that, the chance to film there is obviously visually stunning because you're able to show a world to people that they often just see from a distance and often just with this rather kind of like distancing title of a slum. you know, and it's rather a pejorative word in the way we use it. But in India, it's just it's a location word. It's a geographic word. It just means that's where they live. Because the places inside are full of energy, life, dynamism. They're very organized, cottage industries. They don't have enough resources. There isn't enough sanitation. There isn't running water or not sufficient enough running water. The electricity is intermittent and slightly dangerous. But those things are not their fault. The things that they have responsibility for, they organize amazingly well. And the thing works. And it works so well that it can absorb a film crew, no problem, you know, and let us not only get on with the film, but benefit from their help in making the movie, you know.
The characters in the film initially are presented to us as kids, like little kids, preschool age kids, and these are tremendous actors. If they are actors, how did you cast those roles, these slum kids?
Well, initially the film was written in English, completely in English, and when we got there, I mean, that was how we raised the money from. We raised the money from Pathé in Europe and from Warner Brothers in America. But when we got there, it was clear that the seven-year-olds, because they're 7 years old, really, 6 and 7 years old, the kids, they didn't really speak English that comfortably. A lot of the people that speak English very well there, as you see in the rest of the film, and it's quite easy to present the film in English because it's a natural part of life there to speak English. But the little ones hadn't picked it up fully yet, and so it felt a bit stilted and a bit awkward. And the casting director, Loveleen Tandon, she said, listen, if you want to make that work, you need to translate that into Hindi. She said, I know you can't because of your deal and, you know, the reception of the film in the West, but if you want the film to come alive, translate it into Hindi. So we took a deep breath, translated it into the native language, and it just came alive, the kids. Suddenly, these kids from the slums who we could, you know, you saw when you were going around, we could start auditioning them as well, and the electricity just jumped off the rehearsal room, you know, where we were auditioning.
Well, you know, you mentioned that you, you know, you took these digital cameras into this, you know, these slums and shot these scenes, and you used these kids, you know, from those communities. Did people ever regard you as exploiting them, and did you ever feel that tension yourself?
It's an obvious thing that you're very conscious of going in there, and I'd been very lucky. I'd made another film with kids in the UK called Millions, ironically. And I'd been introduced there to the rules and regulations of working with kids in the United Kingdom, and I believe they're very similar to the United States. They're very restrictive. You only can do a few hours with them. And what we did is, because we knew those regulations didn't exist there, we took our regulations with us and we self-imposed them, really, to make sure that we didn't exploit the kids.
But I guess I meant it more broadly. I mean, more that you're, you know, Westerners with, you know, money and resources coming and into a community of incredible poverty and sort of capturing it for your own benefit. I mean, did it feel uncomfortable?
In theory, that's the case. I kind of like went into it in an almost naive way, really. It felt, the first time I went there, the first time you go is you go to check the script that it's truthful and believable what you're. And I'm very conscious of that, that it has to meet that question. It has to meet that test, really. And it felt it. It felt like it was born of true experiences. It felt like it didn't flatter to deceive, that it wasn't exploitative in terms of, you know, trying to use people for ease and easy emotions. It felt like it was a truthful depiction of a city and of a character, really. So given that you're always exploiting people in every film you ever do, given that that happens anyway, per se, just because you're making a film, it felt reasonable what we were asking people to do, and that provided that we took back a picture of us that was really complex and multifaceted, because the city is impossible to define by one person. You just cannot do the definitive picture about the place. But if you can capture a bit of it, and you do it, you include enough of the experiences that you see there, you'll have a reasonable picture of a reasonably truthful picture of an incredibly complex society, really.
You know, what's remarkable about the story here is that it's you see the characters as young kids in a slum when they're just in terrible poverty, literally living at a landfill and you know, going through the trash for things of value. And as they grow up, you see the city change. And I think what's really remarkable about this, it's not a story just of Indian poverty, but incredible growth and change, and there are skyscrapers and hip nightlife and crowded freeways. And the character ends up, of all places, in a call center. I mean, just talk a little bit about kind of the breadth and scope of the India that's presented here.
The way you describe it, that's exactly what you get. You get this incredible, extreme combinations, which is you get the most abject poverty, people living on landfill sites, and then you get this extraordinary capitalism growing and building there. You know, we can see we've got a problem at the moment in the West with capitalism, is that it's hit a wall because in order to operate at its best, it needs to constantly expand. So it's definitely got room to expand in India, and it is doing. And they'll hit a wall at some point, and it'll be very interesting to see how they deal with it. But for the moment, it's actually got this expansion, throwing up these enormous contrasts between the life that these kids live to begin with and then what they emerge into when they're 18. One brother, because it's a story of two brothers. One brother, like you say, ends up in a call center, where again, although he's just a chaiwala, you know, a guy who goes around serving the tea, he's actually picking up information, which ironically, again, helps him when he gets on the show later. But his other brother, having gone through this terrible violent incident in his childhood, has turned to violence himself and has become part of this gangster regime, which runs a lot of Mumbai is run by gangsters, you know, and mobsters who are benefiting from this huge explosion of capitalism there at the moment and this huge building program that's going on. So it's incredibly complex and rich society you have to acknowledge it, a horrific side. And you can't exclude some of the cruelty that you see, you know, in one way. But then there's this other side of it, which is that life is being lived at this enormously vivid pace. And you've got to just try and include all that and bring it back to people, really, and show, because the world is opening up and there's more of the West heading into India and there's more of India heading for the West as well.
Were there particular challenges to shooting in India that were new to you?
I didn't think of them like that, very deliberately, because everybody says you're going to have problems, there's obstacles, there's challenges, there's difficulties, and I just thought, don't think like that, really, because I sensed the way to get the best out of it was to kind of, like, embrace everything there. So we'd have these enormous setbacks. And you just think, you know, sometimes
like
your
what?
Normal reactions, well, just permissions and kind of impossibility of certain kinds of filming, and you're just endless. And the guys who ran the production for us, who were this local company called India Take One Productions, they would run the whole permissions and the whole official side of the film on a kind of parallel track to the actual filmmaking. It was like a parallel universe that you never really had to. You could visit if you wanted to, but you could make the whole film without seeing that. And it was usually dependent on large sackfuls of cash, to be absolutely honest, this parallel universe. And that's the way the system seemed to operate. And for instance, we applied for permission to shoot from the air in Mumbai. And it's very difficult because it's an island, which people don't realise, and there's lots of naval bases around it. The government's paranoid about national security, understandably, and so they won't let foreigners up in helicopters. So we nominated an Indian cameraman to go up and do it for us. But it took over 14 months to get permission. And they gave us permission about 10 days before we opened at the Telluride and Toronto film festivals this year. So that was no good to us at all. But the parallel universe company were delighted because they will now sell on that permission to some shady company who are making some film about Mumbai. And so the system moves on in its own inexorable, inexplicable, incredible way. You know?
Well, so how did you shoot without permission?
Exactly.
Who knows? See.
These things happen, though, you know? And
you grew up in northern England, is that right, with to middle-class parents?
No, kind of what you call working-class parents,
okay,
actually. But I grew up in just a small town outside Manchester, yeah. My parents were Irish immigrants, really, who settled in Manchester, as many, 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 many people did. You know, working-class parents, decent working-class parents.
And went to religious school and at some point considered the priesthood, but found your way into movies. How did it happen?
Into movies instead, yeah. There's a number of directors, actually, who've nearly become priests, but they become directors instead, which is an interesting connection between those two. My mom was, the dream of her life, really, was that her eldest boy would become a priest, you know. And I was destined for that, but fortunately I was saved from the priesthood by a guy who said, don't, maybe not do this, maybe wait a bit and see what you think. And then, of course, girls, music, you know, all those kind of things arrive in your teenage years. And so I made my way. I started in theatre, actually, and And then I moved into television and then film. In the UK, it's a much easier transition. And a number of the directors you've probably heard of started in theatre. Directors like the late Anthony Minghella, Stephen Daldry, Sam Mendes, they're often starting in theatre and television in Britain and then move across to films, you know?
Well, you know, a real breakout film for you was Trainspotting, which is based on the novel by Irvine Welsh. Got you a lot of attention and a lot of critical acclaim. And I thought we would just listen to a scene. This is very kind of in the opening of the film, and when its central character, Mark Renton, is sort of describing choices that these kids are making in life.
Choose good health, low cholesterol, and dental insurance. Choose fixed interest mortgage repayments. Choose a starter home. Choose your friends. Choose leisure wear and matching luggage. Choose a three-piece suite on hire purchase and a range of fabrics. Choose DIY and wondering who the you are on a Sunday morning. Choose sitting on that couch watching mind-numbing, spirit-crushing game shows, stuffing junk food into your mouth. Choose rotting away at the end of it all, pissing your last in a miserable home, nothing more than an embarrassment to the selfish f***ing brats that you've spawned to replace yourselves. Choose your future. Choose life. But why would I want to do a thing like that? I chose not to choose life. I chose something else. And the reasons? There are no reasons. Who needs reasons when you've got heroin?
And that's from the film Trainspotting, directed by our guest, Danny Boyle. You know, this is, of course, is a story about five young guys in Edinburgh, Scotland, some of whom were in and out of heroin use. And, you know, there's a compelling scene early on that immediately immerses you in this world of heroin users. You know, the one early on where they're in the apartment. Would you just talk a little bit about creating that world?
It's based really on this extraordinary book by Irvine Welsh, who was himself plagued by a relationship with a drug. And in fact says that you never ever, although you give it up, it never ever leaves you. You know, it's always waiting there for you at your lowest moments for your return to it. And it was a book of enormous truthfulness and power about, and surprise really, because he told the story completely from the inside of the people. So you sensed, very controversially, their joy and their dependence on it, you know, what they got from it. And so it's a disgusting, but also an incredibly vivid and alive picture of these people. Really,
you know, you've done such an interesting mix of films. You've got, you know, Trainspotting, which is this intense look at heroin users, and you've got Millions, which is this beautifully touching kind of child fable, a science fiction film, Sunshine, and then 28 Days Later, which is this film of flesh eating zombies. What's next for you? Musical theatre?
I'd love to do a musical. Seriously, I think the holy grail for virtually all directors is a musical, a modern-day musical with new music. I've directed a couple of musical sequences. There's one in, obviously, like you were saying, at the end of Slumdog Millionaire, and I've done a couple in the theatre. I did a little one in Life Less Ordinary here with Cameron Diaz and Ewan McGregor. And when you're directing those sequences, it's such a buzz. There's something about directing something with rhythm. It's so releasing, really. I'd love to do it. But it is the Holy Grail, and I don't think, certainly in the modern day, it's very difficult to know how anyone would ever get there quite with that kind of pure experience of a brand new musical with brand new music, you know. And it's interesting, the ones that have worked, like Moulin Rouge and Mamma Mia, are using music that we're already familiar with. And that's really interesting because, you know, that's how they sell movies in Bollywood, which does use music in every film virtually. They put the soundtrack out a month beforehand. Everybody buys the soundtrack, learns the songs, then turns up to the new movie so that they can sing along or kind of so they're familiar with the music. It's really interesting that watching that in Bollywood, how it operates as a system. No, but I was going to do an animated film actually, which would have completed a surprising selection of films for people. But in fact, that all fell apart. So I would think I'll do a kind of thriller next, really. And I feel that I feel the temptation to do an out-and-out thriller in some way, you know?
Well, Danny Boyle, I guess we're out of time. I wish we could talk some more, but thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Dave.
Danny Boyle's film Slumdog Millionaire is nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Picture.